Hello, I'm Claudia Hammond, and in today's Health Check from the BBC, we're devoting the whole programme to the work of a pioneering British psychologist called Donald Broadbent, who died in 1993. He realised that the way we process the world around us can lead us to make costly mistakes. While he was in the United States, he became determined to apply psychology to everyday life because he witnessed something quite extraordinary while working in the Air Force. The American T-6 aeroplanes had two identical levers under the seat, one to pull up the flaps and one to pull up the wheels. Time and again he saw his colleagues pull the wrong lever when taking off, crash-landing expensive aircraft in the middle of fields, all because the designers hadn't taken human behaviour into account. Donald Broadbent's experiments changed forever our understanding. Donald Broadbent's experiments changed forever our understanding of the way we process information and how we put that information into practice.
He really had the foresight to understand that the major challenge that faces us in behaving as humans is the huge amount of information that's available to us. And what we need to do is to select and navigate our ways through that as efficiently as possible to perform effectively. Before that point in time, no one had framed the problem in these terms.
His work brought about a massive transformation of the way we look at operations of the brain. I think he was a key member of that cognitive revolution that changed the whole of UK psychology and certainly internationally.
He documented many, many new findings, and they've all withstood the test of time. And as a scientist, that's exactly what you hope for. And you can only do that by having the highest standards. So he enshrined absolutely the highest standards of research conduct.
He demonstrated through a series of very neat, clever experiments that this apparently woolly concept of attention could be studied and one could ask precise questions and come up with clear answers.
Donald Broadbent led the way in a field of psychology known as cognitive psychology, how it is that we think and process information. And when you find yourself in a bar that's as noisy as this, you might think it would be impossible to concentrate on what anyone's saying, but remarkably, we can do it. This was the topic of Broadbent's most famous set of experiments, and I've come to this restaurant to meet Professor Dylan Jones, who's head of the School of Psychology at Cardiff University in Wales. So what sorts of processes are we using just to be able to have a conversation like this one and to listen to each other?
Well, first of all, there's the amount of effort you have to put in to delivering your message to the other person. But there's also an active suppression of what's going on around us as well. And this is one of the insights that Donald Broadbent brought to this subject, was that things that we're not attending to also have an effect on us.
In Broadbent's most famous set of experiments on something called dichotic listening, he set out to explore how much we can understand if we're played a series of words in one ear at the same time as we hear different words in the other ear.
8, 6, 9, 6.
Professor Andy Smith is director of the Centre for Occupational and Health Psychology at Cardiff University, and he worked with Broadbent at Oxford University in the late 1970s.
Donald's early experimental studies were concerned very much with selective attention, how we actually focus on certain features of the environment. One of the techniques that we used in a number of laboratories, not just Donald, was what was called dichotic listening. You had different messages played to each ear. If you attend to the message from one ear, how much can you remember from the other ear?
And in certain circumstances, the answer is quite a lot. Broadbent suggested that the mind is a bit like a radio receiving many channels at once. We can separate the incoming sounds and choose which to tune into. Broadbent found that it's easier when one voice is male and the other female, or if one has an accent to help us separate the sounds. As his research continued, he discovered that it wasn't only physical distinctions that enabled listeners to tune into the channel they're not trying to listen to. There was something else going on. Alan Badley, Professor of Psychology at the University of York, also worked with Donald Broadbent.
Subsequently, it became clear that there were other ways in which messages could break in that were more to do with meaning. and that suggested a further complication to the model.
If, for example, someone mentions your name when you're at a party, that tends to grab your attention even though you may have been attending to someone else's conversation. So we don't totally filter out the information. We keep it at a level where important information can still be attended to if necessary.
There's a lot of evidence showing that we do process very familiar stimuli, ones of great significance to us.
Heard the word Claudia then, and I couldn't help but notice that. What was happening, is it?
Yes, one's own name, or sometimes things that are of emotional significance to us.
So this is called the cocktail party effect, although of course it happens places other than cocktail parties as well, I'm assuming, like restaurants like this.
Yes, I mean, it's not called the working men's club problem, but it is a universal experience.
It was Colin Cherry, an engineer at Imperial College, who first brought the cocktail party effect to public attention in 1953. But Donald Broadbent developed the understanding of the phenomenon with his dichotic listening experiments, which revealed the importance of what he called the fate of the unattended. Professor Susan Gathercole of the Cognition and Brain Sciences Unit in Cambridge worked with Broadbent in the early 1980s.
It's very hard to ignore your own name or that of someone who's personally relevant to you. This is very important because it tells us that we are actually carrying out some processing, potentially, of all information, and we are monitoring the environment for critical and personally relevant events. But we're able to balance the allocation of the very special benefits that fully attending to something gives us. The big debate is, what then are we doing with the so-called unattended stream? We're clearly hearing it, and it must be relayed to the auditory processing areas of the brain. And what it probably means is that we carry out some preliminary interpretation of everything that we experience, and that we have some very sophisticated systems that tells us what are important for us, what are personally relevant. And there might be danger signals, or there may just be very personally relevant signals, like one's own name. And for these types of event, we don't need much processing for them to intrude on awareness, and that will enable us to act.
So we're more alert all the time to what's going on around us than we might realise. So if you're at work and it's really busy and you're really trying to concentrate and you're determined to ignore the conversations going on around you, in fact, you're not completely ignoring them.
You're not completely ignoring them. You may never be aware of them, though they may intrude on awareness. And sometimes when they do intrude on awareness, that's a frustration, you sooner than not. But it's because they are signalling something that's important to you. And your cognitive system is smart enough to work that out without you having to devote that much extra mental effort to it.
So you might notice your boss saying something across the other side of the office that might have some consequences for you, and that thing you might notice, whereas you don't notice what everyone else was talking about that was not important.
That's exactly the case.
Quite clever, isn't it?
It is quite clever. And of course, our cognitive system can reveal to ourselves exactly those things that are most important to us, which we might not think of. So it may just be hearing someone talking about a TV programme that you watched the night before that may also intrude.
I've had just that experience. There I am, trying to write a script in the office, determined to filter out other conversations, but then suddenly they're chatting about the latest episode of Homeland. There's no doubt that's distracting. Dylan Jones, somewhere a bit quieter this time.
Distraction is the price we pay for flexibility in attending to things in our environment. If it weren't for the fact that it was being processed at some level that allows the brain to reassign, so we become aware of, let's say, other priorities, that would allow us to attend to something that we'd already been processing in the background, so we can move across in a very sort of efficient and adroit way, rather than just blunder around wondering what had been going on all that time when we were focusing on what was on the internet. So I think it's that capacity to have processing going on in the background, for which we pay a price, but it allows you to be much more flexible and much more adaptive to circumstances.
Broadbent studied the distractions experienced by people working in nuclear power stations and air traffic control towers, and as Andy Smith says, he was always determined to apply his research to real-life workplaces.
Donald had a unique research strategy. It started with the notion that one should really try and deal with practical problems. So, for example, the area I worked in, noise, developed from increasing industrialization and the potential issue that noise could increase human error and reduce people's safety. He would start with this practical problem and then see that to answer it, you had to do controlled laboratory studies. So in the case of noise, people who work in noisy factories are not only exposed to noise, but other dangerous machinery. So you don't know whether, if they have more accidents, this is actually due to the noise or other features of the factory. And then on the basis of these rigorous experiments, he would develop theories which would lead to further studies that could then be tested, and the results of these studies could be taken back to the real life situation and practical recommendations made about the best way forward.
In 1950, he went to work at the Applied Psychology Unit at Cambridge University and became the director 8 years later. The director of today's incarnation of the centre is Professor Susan Gathercole.
One of the very important contributions that Donald did make was to frame a whole new intellectual discipline, which is now known as cognitive ergonomics. And the cognitive ergonomic approach is one which identifies human aspects of design is a really, really important component of the design of new systems. If you take a cockpit of an aeroplane, it's a good example where there is a huge amount of information that's been presented, much of which will just be in relatively steady state, but which the operator has to continuously monitor. Then understanding what's salient, what's going to cue an important change, has informed very much the design of these types of environments. So we know now, for example, that temporal change, something changing not gradually but by quite a large step change, for example in intensity, a light switching on automatically alerts our attentional system, whereas a very slow gradation in illuminance wouldn't do the same thing.
When Broadbent began studying factory workers, the assumption was that they would soon become accustomed to the noisy environment and that it would cease to affect their ability to concentrate. His surprising discovery was that although they felt they got used to it, it continued to affect their cognitive abilities.
People who are working in noise do things differently to people in quiet, and they select different strategies, and this can plausibly account for some of the differences that one finds in error rates and so on. It's well established that errors and accidents are more frequent in noisy environments, largely due to them having less control over the way they're able to perform various tasks. One of the areas that Donald moved into was to look at what's called the irrelevant speech effect, moving away from very intense noise to looking at the sort of exposures that you get in open plan offices.
Now, I've brought Dylan Jones to the brand new BBC offices in the new part of Broadcasting House, and this bit here has been occupied for a matter of weeks. Dylan, what does the evidence say about how much the noise like this could affect our concentration? Do open plan offices work?
Open plan offices are used in organisations for a whole range of reasons. But looking at it from the concentration point of view, clearly they do not. And there's lots of evidence showing that people's mental efficiency changes quite a lot when there's background speech. Typical figures in the laboratory would be a reduction of about 20% in somebody's capacity to remember, let's say, something as simple as a telephone number. But clearly, in activities such as ones involving creativity, novel thinking, not just routine mental tasks, there's an appreciable loss of efficiency. But it's got to be taken in conjunction, of course, with other advantages of having a space like this, which is to allow people to interact. Now, which is a good thing, arguably. But of course, that interaction does have side effects for people who are trying to focus.
People have only been in here a couple of weeks and people are saying it's a bit noisy, but when they adapt, don't we get used to these things?
Yes, it's difficult to tell actually whether what adaptation takes place is one to the sound or the change in organisational structure. The work we've been doing shows that
distraction during mental tasks does not diminish. Very often, irritation with a sound accompanies the lack of efficiency. The irritation goes away, the lack of efficiency does not.
So people will get used to it and they'll say it's fine and that they like it in the end, but they could still be not performing quite as well.
I don't want to infer that they don't know their own minds, but, I mean, it's the degree of awareness of what's going on there that's a really crucial thing. And one of the things that Donald Broadbent was among the first to recognise and to measure properly.
Donald Broadbent led a revolution in cognitive psychology, telling us something fundamental about the way we interact with the world every day. Alan Badley.
The world's full of stimuli and signals. In order to steer our way to practical solutions, we need to be able to focus, and focusing requires attention. So, if you like, attention is the control centre of the mind.
I had a great first meeting with Donald. There was a very lively postgraduate conference that was held every year. He was, of course, the most famous psychologist in Britain, probably internationally at the time, so it was a real coup for us as postgraduates to get him to attend this meeting. Keynote speakers are rather grand when they attend meetings, they quite often come in and go out rather fast, but Donald certainly wasn't like that. He was there in his conference T-shirt, greeting the delegates as they arrived. I'm sure other people will recount this too, that my abiding image of him was with a big grin on his face.
This outgoing side of Donald Broadbent's nature was put to good use in promoting the understanding of psychology amongst the public, with many appearances on TV and radio explaining the subject. I'm guessing he might also have gone to the odd cocktail party. So what I'm left wondering is whether the research that's followed on from Broadbent's can answer that perennial question for party hosts. What's the perfect number of people to invite?
Putting other considerations aside, we found that in the laboratory, as the number of voices goes up beyond six or eight, the kind of sound you get means that you can't discriminate any one voice, so it doesn't impinge as much. And it does vary. I've seen a number of systematic studies with the amount of alcohol that's been.
Today's Health Check from the BBC was produced by Maria Burgess. I'm Claudia Hammond, and I'll be back at the same time next week with more stories from the world of health.